This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Hi, I'm Wayne McPhail, and I was one of the people that originally started the Rabble Podcast Network, and I think that you should support the Rabble Podcast Network and Rabble.ca because there's no other place where you're going to get such a diversity of voices speaking truth to power.
The Rabble Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Show your support by going to www.rabble.ca/donate.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
The high-profile sexual assault case of John Gomeshi has created a storm of reaction over the cross-examination and testimony of witnesses who brought the complaints. In a commentary called No Right to a Discriminatory Defense, three women's equality advocates called for an honest conversation about how to protect full answer and defense without resorting to misogynist standards. Pamela Cross was one of the authors of that commentary. She's a feminist lawyer and the legal director of Luke's Place Support and Resource Center in the Durham region in Ontario. And we caught up with her this morning in Mexico. Hello, Pamela. Thanks for joining me.
Happy to be talking to you, Lorraine.
Now, you have said that in response to the intense cross-examination at the Gomeshi trial, people might get the impression that women's equality advocates didn't care about the rights of the accused. Let's start there.
Sure. I think it is a concern when those of us who are advocates on behalf of survivors of sexual violence talk about our concerns in the present criminal system, that those concerns are misinterpreted. And I speak, of course, for myself. There are other people who might have somewhat different opinions, but I'm a lawyer and I'm a feminist. Those are two things that are equally important to me. And I believe deeply and profoundly in the two underpinning principles of criminal law in Canada that seem to come up in this discussion. The first of those being that we in Canada presume people are innocent until they have been found guilty. We don't think as soon as someone's been charged by the police, oh, that must mean they're guilty. And the second principle, which is, of course, very closely attached to the first, is that before we find that someone is guilty, the judge or the jury has to believe beyond a reasonable doubt that they're guilty. We don't just want to think, well, yeah, you know, it kind of looks like they did it, so we'll find them guilty. It's my belief that we can come up with a system for responding to sexual violence in the criminal court system that does not violate either of those two very important principles.
And probably in this case, it's something to note that that the defendant in this case, John Gomeshi, is somebody with a fair amount of privilege, but that is often not the case in when somebody's facing court procedures.
That's a really important point, and it's one of the things that I think is interesting and troubling about the criminal system. That is that in the majority of criminal prosecutions, the state, who in the courtroom is represented by the Crown Attorney, has far more power than the individual accused person. Of course, there are accused people, as is the case with Gian Gomeshi, who have the ability to retain good counsel who know how to do their job, who have been able to put the proper amount of time into preparing and so on. But there are also hundreds and, in fact, thousands of accused people who move into the court system with no legal representation or with inadequate legal representation. We also know that the court system has serious issues with respect to race, class, ability, mental health issues, and so on and so forth. But what seems to happen in sexual assault trials, and I think this is because of the ongoing belief in so many of the lies and myths about sexual assault, it seems that the power balance shifts so that even an accused who doesn't have access to the kind of high-quality legal representation that we've seen in this case, even an accused who may have a less skilled lawyer, is in a position of greater power, because what happens in that case, especially in cases where the complainant knows the person who has assaulted her or who, in the language of criminal law, has allegedly assaulted her, Because what seems to happen inevitably in these cases is that is the woman whose life is put under a microscope or under a magnifying glass and examined very closely, and she's giving her evidence in an environment, not just in the courtroom, but in the public, because, of course, the media report on these cases closely, as they should, in a context that seems to assume she's got some kind of negative agenda. Maybe she's lying. Maybe she's changing her mind. Maybe she's vindictive. And so all of a sudden, the power imbalance that you described, which is really important and a real challenge in the criminal system where most of the time the accused has less power than the state, that doesn't seem to happen in sexual assault cases.
Now you've alluded to a couple of the ways in which sexual assault cases are different from other criminal trials. Can you just talk about that a bit more?
I think the easiest way for me to talk about it is to compare the kind of cross-examination in particular that happens in a sexual assault case with the kind of cross-examination that might happen, let's say, in a hypothetical situation where you come home from work today and you find that your home has been broken into. The police conduct an investigation, someone's charged. It's someone who lives in your neighborhood. Perhaps you've even met them two or three times at a neighborhood barbecue or something like that. It's not a stranger, but you know, it's not somebody you know well. And this, of course, is the kind of dynamic that is present in many sexual assault cases where the accused person has some knowledge of the complainant. They may be co-workers, they may be students together, they may be neighbors. Now, if you're, if the person who's broken into your house is charged and that case proceeds to a trial, at some point you're going to be a witness because you're going to have to talk about what it was that was taken, what you saw when you came home, and so on. And, of course, you would be cross-examined by the defense lawyer. And I, of course, I can't promise you this, but I can be more than 95% sure that you will not be asked the following kinds of questions. Isn't it true, Lorraine, that you knew the person who broke into your house? And in fact, that you, on a previous occasion, had allowed that person into your house when you had a neighborhood cocktail party? You're also not likely to be asked by the defense lawyer, isn't it true that you left your curtains open when you went to work so that a passerby could see that you had some very nice things in your house? Those are the kinds of questions, of course, about different things, that complainants in sexual assault trials are routinely asked. Didn't you know him? Hadn't you been on a date with him before? Weren't you wearing a short skirt? Why did you have contact with him after the fact, and so on? So I hope that's a helpful way to describe what I see as one of the critical ways in which a sexual assault trial unfolds very differently and in a way that isn't particularly helpful to getting at what really happened.
Now, I guess in addition to that, what we saw in the Gomeshi case was an attempt to discredit the witnesses based on contradictions in their memory. What do we know about the effect on memory and recall of sexual assault trauma?
We know quite a lot, and I want you and your listeners to bear in mind that I'm a lawyer. I'm not a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist, but because I work in this area, I've done a great deal of reading, and I've worked with many, many women who've experienced sexual violence. And as you probably know, and as many of your listeners probably know, especially those of us who are women, you know, many of us have had our own experiences with sexual violence. So it's not just the academic research that tells us this. Trauma has a profound impact on memory. That's one thing we know for sure. And this is based on research done not just with people who have survived sexual violence, but soldiers, post-traumatic stress disorder and syndrome, people who've lived through other highly traumatic events, often have very confused memories. They also remember things out of sequence. So it's not that the event didn't happen, but they may incorrectly remember what color shirt they were wearing that particular day. And these, you know, these are all things that can make it look like a witness is not telling the truth, but in fact she is telling the truth, if there is any such thing as one truth. She's remembering what happened. The other piece of this in terms of what happens for many, not all, but many people who survive a sexual assault in particular, is that because we still live in a culture that doesn't understand how prevalent sexual violence is, how gendered it is. Often, women who have been sexually assaulted need to normalize what has happened. And one of the ways of normalizing what's happened is to kind of pretend it didn't happen. And what better way to do that than to continue to be friendly with the person who has assaulted you? There's a huge amount of embarrassment and shame for many survivors of sexual violence. They don't want to talk about it. They're afraid if they do, people won't believe them or people will blame them and say it's their fault. Again, all these myths, you know, you've gone to a place that any nice girl knows she shouldn't go, or you had one too many drinks, you smoked a joint, you know, whatever. And so women keep the story of what's happened to them to themselves. In this particular case, and I think, you know, it's useful to point to the Gomeshi case as a very high-profile example, but I want to make it clear that this goes on all the time. We just don't know about it. In this particular case, it was 10 years and more before charges were laid. That's not untypical. You know, and possibly if Mr. Gomeshi hadn't found himself in a labor dispute with the CBC, and if there hadn't been all the high-profile attention paid to that, these women might never have come forward. But the fact that there was a delay, the fact that they maintained contact with him after the sexual assault does not invalidate their essential statements, which none of them have changed. They've all told the same story from beginning to end. But what's happened in the case is a kind of, at least, we don't know. We don't know, have any idea what the judge is thinking. But in terms of the atmosphere, the air in the courtroom, it may seem as though these women's stories that they didn't consent are less than believable because they've done things after the assault that people who haven't experienced a sexual assault are unable to understand.
I think many of us, Pamela, who followed the Gomeshi trial were really shocked that the witnesses were subjected to that level of intensity of discriminatory stereotyping. I consider myself a feminist and somewhat aware of these issues, but I was surprised that this was happening in 2016. What's your assessment of why this still goes on?
Unlike you, I wasn't surprised. I was disappointed because I wanted to believe we were better at this than it appears we are. But I guess that's natural. This is the area I work in, and so I had a fairly realistic idea of what to expect. I think this is still going on because as a culture, as a society, we continue to not believe that sexual violence is a prevalent issue, that it is part of misogyny, that it is mostly, not exclusively, but mostly women who are the victims of this crime. It is mostly perpetrated by men. If we want to believe that we live in a world where this doesn't really happen, then we have to concoct stories that make it sort of the fault of the woman. So either she's making it up and it didn't happen at all, or something happened, but she is now the one who's responsible for the fact that it happened because of her personal characteristics or her behavior or actions at that given time. So to address those, you know, we need to fix the criminal system. There's no doubt about that. But we also need to do something much bigger, and that is to change societal attitudes. We need to work for women's equality. You know, lots of people think, oh, we've done that. We've got the Charter of Rights. Well, maybe we've got the Charter of Rights, but women are still earning, what, 72 cents for every dollar earned by men? You know, women are still significantly underrepresented politically, despite the Prime Minister's creation of a gender-equal cabinet, which is a fantastic step. You know, we've got to work for women's equality. We have to start talking about sexuality with children when they're young, and creating a culture in which this just doesn't happen.
If we were to create a system that took into account the trauma experienced by sexual assault survivors, what do you think that would look like?
I think there's a couple of things that need to happen to create that kind of environment, and I think they can both happen without jeopardizing these two principles that we talked about at the beginning of our conversation, the presumption of innocence and the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. One is to step right outside the existing criminal system and say, hey, in addition to the criminal system as it is more or less structured now, we're going to create an alternative approach called restorative justice. It's survivor-led, survivor-driven rather, in the sense that no woman is forced to use restorative justice, but we're going to look at this as an opportunity for healing for the survivor, for learning and accountability on the part of the perpetrator, and we're going to place that in a broader community context so that there is some opportunity for learning and growth on the part of more than these two individuals. But then we need to change within the system itself. And the two ideas I'm going to present, neither of them is going to make this a perfect situation because we're working in a flawed system. In Ontario, which is where I work, we have a system of specialized domestic violence courts. They have not made everything perfect by a long shot, but the creation of those courts is an acknowledgement by the criminal system that domestic violence cases are different and that people need special training, crowns, victim support people, police, judges. Why don't we do the same thing with sexual assault? And then when a case is heard, it's heard in front of a judge who has specialized training. It's prosecuted by a crown attorney who has specialized training. The victim support people who are part of the court system have specialized training. And if we go right back to the beginning, the police have specialized training. The other thing that I think is really important in sexual assault cases is that survivors be provided with the opportunity, not a requirement, but the opportunity to obtain legal advice and legal support, because the crown attorney is not the lawyer for the victim, which is what I think lots of people who don't work in the system believe. The crown attorney is representing the interests of the state, of the country, of the society. And so a victim, and I'm using the criminal law language here, is in court without anybody who's her advocate. We need to change that. And I'm happy to say that I hope Ontario is headed in that direction. The provincial government, under Premier Kathleen Wynne, last year announced a massive sexual violence action plan. And one of the many elements of that plan is to, this hasn't happened yet, but the plan contains a suggestion that we introduce a program in which women could access legal advice without having to pay the cost of that themselves.
It's been fantastic talking with you this morning, Pamela. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
I've been speaking with Pamela Cross. Pamela Cross is a feminist lawyer, and she's the legal director of Luke's Place Support and Resource Center in the Durham region in Ontario.